in Memphis, and welcome to Storyboard 30. This is the show taken right out of the pages of Storyboard Memphis, the nonprofit publication that brings you arts, community, and culture in one place. This is your host, Mark Fleischer. This is a special episode of Storyboard 30, a collaboration with Storyboard's media colleagues at High Ground News and with our contributing sponsors at Neighborhood Preservation, Inc. Today, we are going to be talking about housing and what is really a set of crises as a result of the pandemic and economic shutdowns. As many of us in Memphis and around the country are in isolation, workers are working from home, parents are teaching from home, but there's another part of our community, the traditionally disinvested part of our community. Thousands are dealing with ongoing issues of neighborhood blight and poor living conditions, an oncoming crisis in a wave of mass evictions that we've been hearing about, of course, and even facing a potential shutoff in their essential electric, gas, and water services. That's something else that's popping up. Here to discuss all this, Imani Jasper, she's Program Manager of Neighborhood Preservation, Inc., or NPI. Austin Harrison, who is a former associate with NPI and is now a neighborhood and housing consultant here locally. And I'm also joined by Emily Trenum. She's publisher and community engagement manager of High Ground News, who is here to serve kind of as a co-host today for this special edition of special episode of Storyboard 30. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mark.
So I frame this by talking about a housing crisis, and if you look at all the issues that we're dealing with in terms of the pandemic and the economic shutdown, you know, blanket picture, blanket statement is it's a housing crisis, right? So Imani, I thought we'd start with you from Neighborhood Preservation, Inc. And the Blight team. You know, obviously during a pandemic, you know, the issues that we deal with in neighborhoods in terms of neighborhood blight, those don't, you know, magically stop because we're in a pandemic, right?
Yeah, the problem property on your street remains a problem property when you have to quarantine.
Exactly. And work from home. Yeah. So give us an idea of what your team is having to do, what kind of adjustments the team is having to make here during the pandemic, and also the things that are either ongoing or that are escalating as a result.
So like a lot of people listening, we officially left our office around mid-March with the idea that, you know, for at least the next little while, we're going to have to work from home and figure out how to change some events we were having around to be more of a virtual format, but still try and get the work done because, as you said, like the problem properties don't stop being problems. If there's property blight in a neighborhood before, there's still going to be property blight in a neighborhood now. We just have to continue to work at it while also addressing other issues as they come in. So we're still doing our best to support code enforcement, staying in contact with them, making sure people know to still report those problems to the 311 system, seeing what we can do to help them out. We're still working hard up in Fraser in the Renaissance Apartments, trying to get those finished and people can move into healthy, safe, affordable housing as soon as they can. Still working on our partnership with Klondike Smoky City CDC on how they're going to use those 150 lots they got from the land bank and use those to revitalize the neighborhood. Still working with our partners in the North Memphis area, helping make sure their clients have what they have. We're still promoting neighborhood revitalization, still trying to help out with neighborhood improvement projects, and we're still trying to address systemic barriers to blight. So some things have happened that I've been really proud of. Like, we had the Neighborhood Preservation Summit on March 1st, which was supposed to be in person at Northside. That wasn't going to work. So, hey, we just all did it virtually. We had a couple hundred people participate across the four webinars that day, which are on NPI's Vimeo page if you didn't participate, but we were able to put out that information because you still do want to know how to get information on vacant abandoned properties. You still want to know how you can address litter and illegal dumping in your neighborhood. You still want to know what's being done about vacant and abandoned apartment complexes. You still want to know how the code enforcement processes work. You still have these questions. You have a whole bunch of other questions about, you know, when there's going to be a vaccine, how much longer do we have to do this? But there's some in the meantime that we can start to address. Some of the newer topics that we've had to address and bring up are related to evictions, and we're part of the new eviction settlement program, which is funded by part of the CARES Act, and it what it does is it allows for those who are facing an eviction, whether that's you get an official court notice and a letter with your court date and your case file number, or you get one of those really scary messages from your landlord, things are posted on your door, you're going to be evicted soon. It provides a way for you to get legal representation through MOWS to help represent you in court and potentially work out a settlement with your landlord where you aren't evicted and you can stay in your home and figure out a payment plan. I also do want to mention that there are also rental assistance programs through the CSA. I think MICA has funds as well, and you can find some of these resources at home901.com/COVID-19resources if this is something that you need. So that was a whole mouthful of information, and I'm just going to toss it back to Mark in case he needs me to go back over any of it.
Yeah, let's unpack some of that because, you know, this oncoming wave of evictions is not a new topic. It's not a new issue, right? First of all, as a community, this is something that we've been dealing with anyway pre-pandemic. It's, you know, Memphis, unfortunately, is one of those cities that has had issues greater per capita in some cases in terms of evictions than other cities. So of course that has been, you know, exacerbated because of the pandemic and all that. Also, I should mention that, you know, Austin and Emily, you know, you both talked about this way back in February.
Feels like a lifetime ago, Mark. Feels like a lifetime ago.
totally does. Yeah. And, we all thought about this. Us who, you know, are have any kind of ear to the ground when it comes to housing, you know, when the pandemic hit, the shutdown hit, the economic shutdown hit. You know, I think we all thought, oh, geez, we're going to have an issue here, right? So this is nothing new. What changes the conversation now, I mean, we're recording this during the week of July 27th, and many are getting eviction notices as we speak, right? Some may be getting eviction notices next week. Some may have already gotten eviction notices, you know. We've been reading about this in the Washington Post, the New York Times, that some landlords, you know, they frankly didn't care. And they started eviction proceedings maybe 2 months ago, despite the moratorium. So Austin, I'll throw this to you, you know, looking at all the figures and the data that you have access to, what does this crisis look like nationwide? And what does it look like here in Memphis?
So the best description I've heard of it nationally, but also in Memphis, is a sort of calm before the storm. So I think we need to first, honestly and frankly, realize the impact of government intervention early in the crisis. I think the extended unemployment benefits, the CARES Act moratorium on federally subsidized property, which are, you know, are also, we see as high of a rate of eviction there in a lot of places as we do in market rate. So I think that's one piece. But the CARES Act moratorium, ran out last week. So, you know, just what you said, whether you're in a Section 8 voucher or a low income housing tax credit property, evictions are on the table now for you, especially after this next month. Come August 1, and without further government intervention, which, like you said, we're in the middle of the week. There's a lot of talk about that. We're seeing on the national level of potentially extending that moratoria or possibly adding in those unemployment benefits that have slowed the impact. And then the other thing that I think has slowed it in a lot of places, but also in Memphis, is just confusion around what evictions look like during a pandemic. I know when it first started back in March and April, the courts were closed for a long time. So, I mean, there are cases that for non-payment of rent in February or March that are being heard right now. And then there are also some cases, you know, non-payment of rent in June the last month that are being heard right now. And so I think it's the timing that's really made things interesting. But I think the big thing that everyone is focusing on, and I think that is especially important for Memphis to focus on, is if we had an eviction radar of what was heading for our city, stormy days are ahead unless we do something. I think the eviction settlement program that Imani spoke to at the beginning of the show is going to be really helpful in proactively, you know, preventing and then also giving much needed legal assistance, not just through MALS, but also through the University of Memphis Law School. And I know MPI is also, they have a volunteer a bullpen of volunteer attorneys that are donating their time and effort. And so I think that that's going to be big. But if you look at, like you said, if you look at the numbers and you look at what we're seeing, you look at the trends, the areas that we're seeing the highest impact from unemployment. We recently just wrapped up at Innovate Memphis, a COVID socioeconomic vulnerability study. You can find that out at innovatememphis.com under the news tab there if you want to look into that more. We borrowed a methodology from the Urban Institute, and they had this really important data source that it has been missing from the conversation for a while, and that's COVID-related unemployment filings. And so at the neighborhood level, we were able to see how many folks are losing their jobs. And the reality is, where that is happening, much like the virus itself, is spatially concentrated largely in communities of color. And I think because of that, in your traditionally class neighborhoods, your Fraser, your White Havens, your Raleighs, your Southeast Memphis, your Cordovas, your Bartletts, these neighborhoods that are middle income, working class, and the ones that even post foreclosure crisis have been seeing some stability in their markets, they're at the highest risk of really seeing some impact, both from the eviction side, but also from the larger housing issue side. So,
yeah, it's unfortunate that, you know, I've had this conversation now quite a few times, in that the pandemic has really simply exacerbated the issues we've already had as a city. The issues in the disinvested communities of color, as you mentioned, you know, the pandemic has only exacerbated all these issues and made that much worse for these communities. Throughout the show, I'm going to mention the website because I think it's worth repeating throughout. Again, for those listening who are looking for some kind of assistance in terms of eviction proceedings, it is home901.org. So HOME901.org. And there's a COVID-19 resources tab in that site for assistance. So I'll repeat that throughout the show. Emily Trenum, I want to give you a chance to chime in here. High Grand News, with the help of, I want to say Barris Kursikal, reporter for High Ground, published a story last week about not only this eviction crisis, but also one of our local nonprofits that has stepped in to help renters receive assistance.
Yeah, the Works in South Memphis. I mean, they, of course, they have, are also concerned about foreclosure. And so they reached out to the people they have helped get mortgages to see how they're doing. But also they are the managing partner of a low income housing tax credit project that's right there at their offices in South Memphis. And so they've been reaching out to those individuals to see, you know, how they're doing, provide assistance with budgeting. And I mean, that's the kind of one-on-one assistance that is really beneficial. And I hope that, unfortunately, there's not a lot of, financial resources to support organizations that are doing, eviction counseling, eviction assistance. So we need more of that and to help people, get back on track in any way they can.
Speaking of assistance, back in now a month ago in late June, the Commercial Appeal published a story by Michaela Watts about a relief fund. Federal funding was available to the tune of $2 million to help fight eviction filings in Shelby County. Imani, Austin, Emily, do you have any further information on how any of those monies are being distributed to renters?
I think I think the renter relief funds through the CSA Community Service Association, I think that's part of that funding is how that's being allocated and sent out. Um, think you still apply through their website, through the 211 system to get access to that. Some of that funding is also going towards the eviction settlement program. So I think it's going around in a couple of different ways.
I mean, I'm interested in you know, hearing from Austin or Imani about policy interventions that could be, you know, helpful here, sort of in the longer term, because, I mean, of course, there's bad actors among landlords at any size, but even the, you know, the responsible landlords and property owners, you know, have pro formas and have, you know, mortgage payments to make themselves and utilities and staff costs. And just seems like there needs to be some kind of policy interventions to help the whole, address the whole problem and not just at the, not just on the tenant side. I just don't know what that looks like.
Yeah, I think it can look like a lot of things. Emily, and let me start by saying, I think the eviction settlement program that we've been talking a lot about is a great first step, but we have to realize that it really is just that. It's a first step. I think the larger system that you're mentioning, Emily, which a lot of that gets into the way rental property has skyrocketed in Memphis. And most of that are still local folks, but there's also a high number, fast growing number of out of town investors that from the foreclosure crisis in 2008, received bulk sales and bulk transfers of single family homes, and are, you know, private equity firms. And it's not to paint those individuals or anyone who works for them or rents for them as bad people. I think they're doing what we're all doing, just trying to make it through. But the impacts that has from a policy standpoint is it becomes very difficult to hold those individuals accountable. So something I've advocated for, and MPI has done some work with this. I'm not sure where this is at now. Maybe Imani could speak to that. But a way to hold those actors accountable through a registration or licensing system is a big step on the landlord side. It's common in other parts of the country, not so common in the South. But this would basically be just a formal license. You would, as a landlord, you would pay a small fee, sign your property up, and want to be systematically inspected. And if you're a good landlord and you're providing a good product, then you have nothing to worry about and it's going to be little to you, but this will allow us to begin to market and understand some of those bad actors who again are a small population. I don't want to stress this enough. There are so many landlords that are doing great work and have been working with their tenants, and I've heard so many empowering stories of that partnership. But that's not the entire story. There are bad actors out there in anything and in all things we have in life, and I think that's true for housing as well. And what that registry would allow us to do is see those individuals, because right now it's hard to look at the interior condition, and where Memphis is losing most of its affordable housing, studies have shown, is from the bottom of the market. So by that I mean properties aren't getting too expensive. A lot of people, you'll hear a lot of people say Memphis is a cheap place to live. We have plenty of affordable housing. But what's happening is those units that are available at, you know, $600, $500, $400 a month are substandard, to say the least, potentially inhabitable in most cases, and should not be lived in by low to moderate income families in Memphis. And that creates health issues, that creates education issues, especially in a time when we're sheltering in place. If the place you are sheltering gives you lead elevated blood levels, if it gives you asthma, if it has other negative health or emotional or mental impacts on you, that's something we should really, as a city, look to do. And I think if we're able to save some of that supply, it has affordable housing impacts, it has neighborhood stabilization impacts, and most importantly, it has economic impacts, because the landlords will be quick to tell you that the rents will go up, but that has not been shown in any other place where rental registries, Cleveland, Ohio, Detroit, Michigan, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Ohio has a state rental registry. And none of those places have they seen increased rents because of the registry. And so I think this is a smart step we can take locally to hold some of these bad actors accountable on that landlord side. But obviously, in addition, and we can talk more about this later, but in addition, I think tenant advocacy and educating tenants on their rights at a scalable level is something I know a lot of groups, the Works has done a lot of good work in South Memphis with that. other groups like Center for Transforming Communities and MICA and other activists are beginning to scale some of that up throughout the city. But I think that's the next big thing Memphis can do that will, you know, inform some of those policy recommendations.
So I just said jump in there on the rental registry. So that is one of the action items under the Black Elimination Steering Team Action Plan, is to continue to support a rental registry in Memphis. It would also help if you need to get in contact with your landlord, you have someone you can get on the phone and can come actually to a court date and you can get a response from them. So also inspection and making sure that, you know, your housing market isn't decaying, that someone is going to be responsible to that tenant and responsive to them, are all very important things. In terms of policy things, if we think of evictions as a coming tidal wave, anything that sort of takes the force out of it. So whether that's a moratorium on eviction filings, again, to give people some more breathing time in between when they have to make payments or unemployment benefits, to make sure that they can chip away at that balance of past due rent. Any of those things are also going to continue to help, and this week are federally at least being discussed, is on the table.
So two quick things to that. One, I'd love if you can speak more to what's happening with the rental registry, because I think that's a big problem, and I know it's been on the best radar for a while. So if you have a more detailed update, if not, no big deal. Secondly, just one point of clarification I want to make with the eviction moratoria, it's important to note that would require Tennessee state law to change. Memphis right now, if they wanted to, and the mayors of both city and county have said this, their hands are tied by state law here, and there's a preemption on Memphis doing that. There's been other groups around the state who have worked to try and force Governors Lehans to maybe, let that preemption go during the pandemic. But to my knowledge, it hasn't happened yet. So just so folks don't, you know, go call their city councilors tomorrow and start pushing for that. I mean, it's really the state that if we wanted to have that larger eviction moratorium, we'd have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
As far as like an update on the registry, we have the white people have done a lot of research behind why it's a good idea. We've come up with some ideas. We know that Public Works is pushing for it. And so that's, as far as I know, is an update where it is currently. It's something that, you know, it is an important item, but there's now a lot of also important items on the table. So I don't have a more recent update on that one. I know that broke your heart.
From a renter's point of view, you know, if, you know, and again, I think of folks listening to this who are facing the reality of a potential eviction, and, you know, the renters have rights. And I want to make sure that, you know, for those listening who might be facing a situation, that your best course of action, first of all, is to try to reach out to your landlord, obviously. Your landlord is not going to be surprised to hear that you might have an issue. I think everyone knows about the pandemic, in other words. But we want to make sure that people know that that as a renter, you do have rights. And, you know, part of your right is, you know, or part of exercising your right as a renter is to stay in place. You know, you have a lot of rights as a renter if you simply stay in place. It takes months of proceedings to get to a point of actually being evicted. You know, landlords have to go through certain steps to actually get to that point. So I want to make sure that that's clear too. I'm going to repeat one more time, another time here, the website for assistance, home901.org, home901.org. And there's a COVID resources tab there for assistance.
Renters do have rights. The Memphis Fair Housing Center does have a rental rights and responsibilities guide. They do not have a lot of them printed. That will probably be difficult to get now, but there are resources that exist that are lay out what your rights are as a tenant, what your responsibilities are as a tenant, and what your landlord's responsibilities are. So there's a lot of this resource at least out there. And if I have to personally scan it and put it somewhere, I'll try and make sure that people know where they can get this information.
Emily, did you have something?
Well, just wanted to observe that to me, I know Congress is negotiating a new relief bill. And to me, this is another reason why ongoing financial assistance is important, not just a moratorium, because ongoing financial assistance from the government, whether it's the extra unemployment money or the $1,200, hopefully both, allows people to actually continue paying their rent. And certainly from the perspective of you know, the small landlords, let's just say the good guys for the moment. We know there's a lot of them that are not, you know, giving people resources they can pay their rent. So they're not just holding it off until the end when they have a huge bill.
Yeah, that's worth reminding everyone of, because mm-hmm. Congress has been looking at, you know, various remedies to help renters. But for the most part, the CARES Act has not put a hold on actual rents, meaning if the moratorium does not say that you don't have to pay April, May, and June, it says those are put on hold. Unfortunately, the renter is liable for those rents the way the CARES Act is structured currently.
It said it's a moratorium on eviction, so you can't be evicted for non-payment of rent. It's not forgiveness of rent for those months.
Right. Yeah. Austin, you want to talk about the, there's a white paper.
Can I jump in here and please, sort of ask a question related to that? Austin, I do want you to talk about this new research that you have just issued that really looks at vacancy in different kinds of cities around the U.S. But part of that, I guess, is just talking a little bit of, and you touched on this earlier, on the connection between evictions and vacancy, because, of course, that, you know, vacancy is just really, you know, bad for a neighborhood, and looking down the road at, you know, from a people perspective, we think of people becoming homeless, people having to double up, but from the, you know, the place perspective, evictions are going to lead to greater vacancy. So maybe that's a jumping off point to talk a little bit about your research, if you can connect those dots better than I just did.
Well, I think you did a great job, Emily, because the real key point here is vacancy is bad for landlords too. I mean, that's the other bigger picture here. We're all in this together, and so a tenant getting evicted not only destabilizes their housing situation, not only disrupts their life and maybe a tipping point into poverty, but it also has larger economic impacts that really create it's bad for the landlord. Now those small landlords who own 1, 2, 3 properties, they have trouble paying that bill and filling that. And so I think vacancy is at a high level, it's problematic. But at the same time, the other side of that token is there's a certain amount of vacancy that helps the market and at a healthy level. So what we looked at in this recent research is the not so healthy vacancy, long-term vacancy. So using the Postal Service, shout out to the Postal Service. They do a great job on doing a lot of things, but they also track vacant properties and they have data available, publicly available data that is really some of the best at tracking vacancy in neighborhoods. And so we use that in the top 200 metros in America, but specifically looking at the Sun Belt, which is most of the Southeast and going out to Southern California. Comparing that to what's commonly called the Rust Belt to the Midwest. And we use this long-term vacancy. So we define that as 6 months or longer. So a house has been for a while, you know, it's been on the market. It's been vacant for a long time. And we found that in the 10 years, roughly 10 years, we did 2011 to 2019, following the last housing crisis we faced, 2008, the Great Recession, vacancy didn't go away in a lot of places. The national narrative has been, we're out of the Great Recession. Markets are back on the rise. We're talking a lot about the cities like your New Yorks, your LAs, your DCs, your Miamis that have really done well. But the reality is a lot of cities still have high areas of concentrated vacancy, these areas of disinvestment, Mark, that you've been mentioning throughout the show, that I think are really important, because those areas have not become unvacant. There are still concentrated vacancy. And I think a lot of folks listening to the show know that. They probably live that. They may have some on their block. I know I do. And there's these vacant properties that are long-term nuisances, and the owners are making those changes. And so from a policy standpoint and from a COVID policy standpoint, it really creates another layer to this perfect storm we're talking about, and that vacancy is still there. And if we have this wave, this housing crisis, this large non-payment of rent, non-payment of mortgages, you know, both of those are tied. You saw in 2008, someone would get an eviction filing because their landlord didn't pay their mortgage. You know, that all is connected. And so I think that's another place to tie these two issues, is we're really talking about ways to stabilize the Memphis housing market, which would be best case scenario for everyone in this time. If we can get through this without seeing, you know, 15, 20% foreclosure rates like we saw at the height of 2008, without seeing, you know, these non-payment of rents coincide with that. Because that's the other big thing about Memphis is in 2008, we were a predominantly owner-occupied city. Now we're the fastest growing rental market in America by a 2018 Zillow report, and we're now 56% renters. And so it's flipped entirely. We're now majority renters. And so if renters have trouble paying their rent, landlords have trouble paying their mortgages, vacancy, which is already there in a lot of areas, increases again, which no one wants to see. It's really stayed stagnant in the years following our research show. That really does create this kind of perfect storm of larger economic impacts. But most importantly, it creates a lot of destabilization when no one wants that right now in the middle of the pandemic.
Again, I'm going to mention the website where renters can get assistance. That is home901.org, home901.org. And there's a COVID resources tab on that screen.
So what kind of resources are available at that link, Austin or Imani?
I can speak a little of that, and then Imani can maybe give more. So there's really two key interventions. One for those who have already had an eviction filed against them and they have a court date, and help find legal assistance, which looking at the data, I'd venture to say that with an educated, you know, guess that we're talking probably 98 to 99% of cases at the court, which those who haven't gone through the process may not realize, it's a defendant, the tenant representing himself. And any of us who have spent time around attorneys or have watched Law and Order or whatever know that that's difficult because it's an entirely different language that they speak there. And then specifically for our non-native English speakers, it becomes additional level. I've done a number of court watches and cannot follow along at all. So that's troubling, and it helps solve that problem. And then the second thing is there is that rental assistance money that was mentioned earlier, where they will settle with, they will work with the landlord, they will negotiate a settlement, a payment plan, a debt payment plan that will allow the person to stay in their home and will allow the landlord to have their funds. And then the additional good part of that I'm really proud to admit that the task force pushed for is that comes with it an inspection of the property. So this could also be a way, we were talking about that rental property issue and the lack of inspections. Now for the landlord on their side, for them to have that money and to be made whole with their rent, the negotiation here is you have to, you know, let us make sure that what we're keeping this person in is a good place to live.
Emily, I have a question for you from a media standpoint, because I'll tell you, doing just Google searches, searching some of our local resources, searching some of the national, Washington Post, New York Times and all that, there's not a lot of information on eviction. So do you feel like from a media standpoint, Emily, that this is perhaps has been underreported?
I think there's probably an element of people waiting to see, you know, what Congress is going to do next. But yeah, I do think it's been, I would argue that, of course, a lot of these situations are not, you know, a lot of conditions that affect families, low and moderate income families don't get the proverbial ink that they deserve. But I do think this has been kind of underreported. And I think it's Imani called it sort of a tidal wave. And I think it's, for a lot of people, a looming crisis because it's kind of been paused. But at some point, the floodgates are going to open. It's going to move from sort of urgent to critical. We're probably going to see, shouldn't have to wait that long to hear more about it, but that could be the case.
Yeah, because I'm seeing numbers nationally, you know, some reporting I see 11 million, and other times I'll see 28 million. So perhaps it's also a little bit of not knowing exactly just how many folks nationwide are going to be affected by this.
Yeah, and I would say too, just real quick, I would say that it's also, there's so much regional divergence in that the policies that were there before COVID the way governments at the local and state level have responded to the COVID-19 crisis with this specific vision on the housing issue. If anyone's interested and they're nerds like us on this, the Eviction Lab has a COVID-19 housing policy scorecard that ranks the states. And you can see it for yourself, but Tennessee gets a 0 out of 5 on a 0 to 5 scale. We have a 0. And there's only like 6 or 7 states in the country that have a 0. So, and a lot of them are in the South. So I think that's an issue too, that nationally we're seeing the South become the hub of COVID-19 cases. And you combine that with the fact that, you know, this looming crisis, if it hits us now, where it's going to hit the hardest because there aren't the policy systems in place to prevent it, the floodgates, so to speak, is going to be in cities like Memphis and your Birminghams and your Little Rocks and, I mean, New Orleans. I mean, these strong, vibrant cities are that's where this looming crisis is going to hit hardest.
I mean, one of the things, of course, we've been talking primarily about low and moderate income families for good reason, but you know, middle and upper middle class, you know, working professionals have also lost their jobs and are experiencing financial, a lot of people don't have much of a safety net. So often, do you see more evictions at the sort of the moderate income level, and how will those potentially impact the community, do you think? Will there be trickle down of people to less expensive housing? Do you have any thoughts about that? But putting you on the spot, I realize we didn't talk about this in advance. Do you have any thoughts about that?
No, you're not. I love this question. And it's something I've been thinking a lot about because the Memphis market is funny in that, you know, our inner ring suburbs, you know, your Cordovas, your Arlingtons, your Bartletts, those are not, in some cities, those are, you know, like in a Detroit, for example, your entering suburbs are some of the wealthiest census tracts in the state. That's not the case for most of the towns that surround Memphis that we do see as primarily moderate income. And I think that's troubling because what the research has shown is housing doesn't filter like an automobile does, right? So if I buy a 2020, you know, Subaru, someone else can maybe buy that for me 10 years from now and it still will get them where they need to go. Housing economically doesn't work like that. And so I think that trickle down piece, what we have seen is when someone faces even as much as an eviction filing, not even going through the judgment, but just having that eviction filing on their record, when their next place they go to live, which could be a 1,000, 1,500, you know, nice apartment, they're going to run a background check. And that good, stable place to live that they can afford is now not going to be available to them. Because they've had that eviction filing. And so I think there are those destabilization impacts that could be a problem.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of my questions was going to be about how Congress and even perhaps our local representatives, how proactive they have been or have not been with regard to this issue. Because like you said, an eviction filing, you know, goes on a credit report, and that becomes an issue later on when someone tries to, you know, is renting another property somewhere else. So my broader question would be, what do you all think? Do you think that our representation, and I'm talking locally as well as nationally, you know, on a congressional level, do you think they've been proactive enough, or have they dropped the ball here?
My personal opinion, and I'll let Imani weigh in, my personal opinion is that locally, in every case that I've seen, our local leaders have done everything they can to take steps. I mean, we've been, you know, pushing for eviction programs and support. And now, you know, the city's like, we're going to take the money we're getting from the federal government, which keep in mind, that money was getting pulled 50 million different ways. And they said, no, this is important to us. We're going to be proactive with this. So I think the city, Mayor Strickland, you know, Director Paul Young at Division of Housing Community Development, those officials have done everything they can. Same goes for on the county level, because, you know, Mayor Harris has pushed the county community service agency as well as the county housing group to be involved in that eviction settlement work. So I think locally we've done well. At the state level, the fact of the matter is you have Chattanooga, Knoxville, Nashville, and Memphis that are looking night and day from the rest of the state. And the majority of our representation comes from the rest of the state, where this is a very different issue and dynamic. And so they don't have, you know, they're not as close to it. And so I don't think they've taken the steps they could take at the state level. And that's not to speak ill of any of the agencies that are doing what they can do. But I think from a policy standpoint, again, you know, just looking at the data objectively, there's more that they could be doing to set up vulnerable Tennesseans to be protected from eviction.
I think if we want our recovery from COVID-19 pandemic, from the growing eviction issue to look the way we want it to, where people aren't negatively impacted down the road by having an eviction filed, where they aren't evicted in the first place, where they have access to quality housing and aren't discounted from it because of marks on their background check, I think we are going to need a much larger effort than what we've seen so far. Partially because while it was a large issue in Memphis, again, as Austin said, it wasn't as much of an issue in the parts of the state that are also heavily represented in the state legislature. But now it's gonna be an even larger number of folks with this eviction on their record, with this Scarlet E, as it's referred to often in the literature. And so there probably will need to be, in my personal opinion, more of an effort to either not have that counted or have it counted less on credit reports and looking at tenants in the future. But of course, also the landlords will need to have their own methods to make sure that they're renting to someone who can meet the rent, but there's gonna need to be a little bit more than we've seen so far.
There's so many impacts of COVID-19 that I'm just so worried about from our community. And one of the things we've all talked about, all four of us, is that, you know, it took so long for Memphis to come back from the foreclosure crisis and some of our neighborhoods to really rebuild, and they were on a very positive trajectory. And so I'm concerned that this is going to, you know, the eviction and then also, you know, the other financial economic impacts are going to really diminish that. And that's a great concern to me.
On that note, Emily, I think that's a great point. And I do want to, you know, let the listeners know that if they're interested in learning more about this connection between the two crises, so by that, I'm referring to 2008 Great Recession and the current COVID housing crisis we're experiencing now. Next month, there will be a report released in partnership led primarily from the City of Memphis, the Division of Housing and Community Development, that same local leadership that's being proactive. They are working with Innovate Memphis and myself to produce a report that really frames where we're at right now. If Memphis is going to respond to this, if we're going to do everything we can at the local level to respond to this, let's take a look back 10 years ago and see how we responded from 2008. Even federal dollars, even federal programs that come down, how they get implemented. The eviction settlement program is a great example of this. How they get implemented at the local level matters. And so while we're pushing our federal representatives, at the local level, there are things we can do that we can control. And so that report's going to dive deeper into this connection between 2008 and where we're at right now, and how the market rebounded and how the policies that were implemented created the situation we're in, and how that could, you know, play out in the COVID crisis. So just highlighting that point, and if anyone's more interested in diving into that, be on the lookout for that report next month.
And these are huge crises that we're facing. I am the person who always wants to sign the silver lining if there's any dim, tiny piece of optimism to find in any of this, is that a lot of the organizations I work with and a lot of the partners that I work with have not stopped grinding hard to try and make Memphis better, even in the face of a pandemic, or that's trying to figure out how they can, on the fly, expand housing counseling to get to any homeowners who are having issues, to make sure that they can provide assistance. And whether it's the work, what the Works is doing, trying to make sure, working hands-on with the people in their community and the housing that they manage, to make sure that they're supporting them. With all the different community groups finding new ways to be engaged and to get feedback, even though we can't come together as we have been. So there are huge crises that we're facing, but I also think we have a lot of good talent and groups in Memphis that are also working hard to make sure that we don't tumble completely back down the hill.
But it's important to note that not all nonprofits were as fortunate as the Works and MPI and a handful of others to still have significant funding. So yes. I would push local government to give money and include support for nonprofits and future relief bills, and also anyone who is able to find nonprofits they believe in that are doing the great work, because I know a lot of them have fallen on hard times. And while there is a small group that haven't, a lot of them have, and I think that could only exacerbate everything we're talking about.
So once again, the resources available to renters facing Eminent Evictions, home901.org, home901.org, and there's a COVID-19 resources tab there. Mm-hmm. Imani Jasper, NPI, Austin Harrison, Neighborhood and Housing Consultant, thanks, extraordinaire.
Appreciate it. I'm enjoying
it. Thank you both. And Emily Trenum, of course, with High Ground News, in collaboration with Storyboard for this episode, this special episode of Storyboard 30. Thank you all for joining me and Emily this episode. This was a very important discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks you for having it. Yep.
And this is your host, Mark Fleischer. This has been a special edition of Storyboard 30 from your friends at High Ground News, Storyboard Memphis, and the Memphis Public Libraries. Thanks, as always, go to producer Vance Durbin, to WYPL broadcast manager Tommy Warren, and to WYPL for their support. And to you listeners and supporters of the library, FM 89.3 and Storyboard Memphis, join us next time on Storyboard 30 for more conversation with those Memphis personalities and shapers who make our lives here in the Bluff City just a little bit better. Memphis, make it a great week and stay safe out there.